If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
North Highland, Sacramento.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. When we talk about affordable housing here in the Bay Area, we're normally thinking of apartment buildings, older homes, and public housing developments. But throughout our region, mobile home parks play an important role in providing housing for lower-income people in places like Sunnyvale, Sonoma County, and out east. They're facing now new conditions, namely the growth of private equity firms that are buying up mobile home parks. We're going to talk about the state of mobile home living and how residents are coping with change. It's all coming up next, right after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shay Stevens. Senate Republican leaders say lawmakers will vote on a health care proposal later this week. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports on the debate over health care subsidies that expire at the end of the year.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune says Republicans support a plan that redirects money from health care subsidies to consumers to use in health savings accounts.
It delivers the benefit directly to the patient, not to the insurance company, and it does it in a way that actually saves money.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is urging Republicans to back the Democratic bill that extends the current subsidies for 3 years.
The choice is simple for them. Vote with Democrats to keep costs down, or vote to send premiums through the roof.
The Senate will vote on both bills on Thursday, but neither plan is expected to get the 60 votes needed to advance. If Congress fails to act, millions of Americans will see health care costs go up in January. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, The Capitol.
President Trump promoted his economic policies during a rally tonight in northeastern Pennsylvania town of Mount Pocono. Trump told those gathered that his administration has already secured pledges for billions of dollars in new investments thanks to his tariffs.
All of the companies that are pouring their money to building right now, building plants in Pennsylvania and many other states, auto plants, AI plants, plants of every type, which we would have never had if we didn't put the tariffs on. Did you see where Europe now is saying, I think we got to start doing what Trump is doing?
Trump blamed inflation on Democrats, but says prices are starting to fall. The president also called Pennsylvania a dumping ground for migrants from what he called the most dysfunctional places on earth. For the first time in its history, the city of Miami has a female mayor. From member station WLRN, Joshua Ceballos reports that some observers say the vote may signal a blue wave in Florida.
The ballroom of the Miami Woman's Club shook with a throng of supporters chanting for Mayor-elect Eileen Higgins. Higgins' victory marks the first time in nearly three decades that a Democrat will hold the mayor seat in Republican-dominated Miami. Laura Kelly is chair of the Miami-Dade County Democratic Party, and she sees the result as a major shift after the 2024 election cycle.
But this is a resounding indictment on President Trump. He tried to interfere in this election. And the fact of the matter is, his policies, and more importantly, his party, is deeply unpopular.
President Trump endorsed Higgins' opponent, Emilio Gonzalez, who lost by 19 percentage points. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Ceballos in Miami.
On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed ahead of the Federal Reserve's decision on interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 179 points. The Nasdaq added 30. This is NPR. Pope Leo XVI is criticizing the Trump administration's effort to loosen U.S. ties with the European alliance. When asked about the U.S. peace plan for Ukraine, the Pope said what he's read indicates a huge change in what was a true alliance. Leo has met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Rome, saying that Europe's role is crucial to any peace deal. The Pope says that securing any agreement without Europe's input is unrealistic. A museum in Washington State currently houses the largest display of nutcrackers in the United States. NPR's Vanessa Romo takes us inside.
The two-story jewel of whimsy and obsession is called the Leavenworth Nutcracker Museum. It houses more than 9,000 handcrafted nutcrackers. And presiding over it all is Arlene Wagner, who just celebrated her 101st birthday. She says she's been collecting all manner of nutcrackers since 1976. And in 1995, with a collection of 7,000, she and her husband thought it was time to share it with the public.
That was the whole idea of starting the museum, was to let other people enjoy what we enjoy.
Wagner traces it back to the nutcracker she got when she ran a ballet company that was performing, well, you know. She says what started out as a one-off acquisition snowballed into a legacy. Vanessa Romo, NPR News, Leavenworth, Washington.
U.S. futures are flat in after-hours trading on Wall Street. On Asia-Pacific markets, shares are mostly lower, down a fraction in Tokyo. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This week in KQED Arts, it was a tough year for Bay Area theater, but it still produced a lot of standout moments. Joan Baez in the circus and Hamlet reimagined with barbecue. That's at kqed.org/arts. It's going to be mostly clear tonight with lows in the 40s. Wednesday will be foggy in the morning, sunny in the afternoon. There's a high risk of sneaker waves at the beach. Highs tomorrow will be in the 60s for the Bay region. Sacramento will be foggy all day tomorrow with a high of 46.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. In California, mobile homes make up, say, 6% of the state's housing stock, with as many as 300,000 homes and 5,000 mobile home parks in the state. These places are a crucial part of the state's affordable housing picture. Though few have been built in recent decades, the mobile home parks that do exist are facing pressure from private equity firms that have found ways to squeeze a few more dollars out of people on the lower end of the income scale. But residents, who've often been in a community for years, are fighting back too to preserve their places in the Bay Area. Joining us to help us understand the issues that mobile home park residents face, we've got Mariah Thompson, senior litigator with the California Rural Law Center. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We've got Bruce Stanton, general counsel for the Golden State Manufactured Homeowners League. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. Thanks. Good to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you. And we've got Randy Keller, who's with the Manufactured Home Parks Acquisition and Advocacy Manager with the California Center for Cooperation Development. Welcome, Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on your show.
So, Mariah, let's go with you first. As a senior litigator there at the Rural Law Center, you've been working with mobile home communities for quite some time, over a decade. What are the kinds of communities that you end up representing?
Yeah, thank you. So California Rural Legal Assistance is a statewide nonprofit legal aid. We've been around for about 60 years assisting rural Californians with all sorts of issues, including housing. My clients tend to be on the margins of when it comes to home ownerships in terms of economics. So we typically represent farm workers, residents with a fixed income, seniors, folks that are at or below the 200% of the poverty line.
And what are the kind of economics of the communities that these folks are living in?
Yeah, so traditionally, mobile home parks have been one of the last, kind of bastions of affordable housing throughout the country and across California. There's currently over 375,000 mobile home park spaces in California, representing about 5,000 parks. And typically, the folks in these communities are, families that are working low-wage jobs or young families, like I said, folks living on fixed incomes, a lot of veterans and seniors, and folks that have been able to have access to home ownership because mobile homes have typically been fairly affordable. I've had many clients that have acquired their homes directly from the prior owner for under $10,000 or around $10,000. And the clients that I represent, they're typically living in mobile homes that are from the 1960s, 1970s, and are more of an aging housing stock.
Hmm. And in this case, okay, they own the home, but by that you mean they literally own the building, like the four walls, wherever that home is. They don't own the land, right?
In most circumstances, yes. When we're talking about parks, they are typically renting the property that is beneath the home, but they do own the home. The thing that makes mobile home parks different is that the home, despite the name, is not usually movable. Mm-hmm. So they own an asset that is fixed in place, but they don't own the land that it's affixed to.
Mm-hmm. You know, Bruce Stanton, you know, there are all kinds of different mobile home communities, each with their own kind of particularities. What are our mobile home communities in the Bay Area like?
Well, thanks. And I would just say Mariah really, I think, explained well what sort of an industry we have here. Parks can range from as small as 10 to 20 spaces to as large as over 800 spaces. Mm. You know, typically a park has common area facilities such as clubhouse, swimming pool, sauna, laundry rooms. There's going to be overflow or guest parking in most parks. Sometimes there's special amenities provided, like a dog run or something. And there's a few parks that even have very unique features, such as a house and an older building that's part of the park property. But what we are finding is there are less and less mom and pop park owners and an increasing number of larger corporations, some of them even out of state, that are acquiring parks because they're seen as a real cash flow bonus for them. You know, the homeowners are basically renting dirt. Mm-hmm. And which they place their personal property structure that they have, you know, complete obligation to repair and keep up. They pay mortgage and you know, loan fees, whereas the park's responsibility is the infrastructure.
Mm. Are those companies, I've been wondering this, are those companies sort of starting to vertically integrate? Like, do they offer loans now too, in addition to renting the thing? Or are they pretty much sticking with that traditional business model of just kind of renting the dirt, as you put it?
They are pretty much sticking to the traditional model, but in the process of that, they're looking for ways to increase cash flow. And if they're purchasing a park in a rent-stabilized jurisdiction, which there are currently just over 100 cities and counties throughout California that have some form of mobile home rent stabilization, they're looking for ways to decontrol the spaces. You know, that could be, in the most extreme case, an eviction or otherwise challenging the ordinance, or something that Mariah and I are all too familiar with is filing petitions or applications for fair return under the ordinance, seeking to increase beyond what the annual rent adjustments the ordinance allows, are by saying, you know, we're not getting a fair return, we're not keeping up. And sometimes these petitions get filed literally within months of the new park owner taking ownership, which is pretty interesting.
So do all these mobile home parks, are they all subject to some kind of rent stabilization or rent control, or just like some subset of them? And what is the subset of them?
Yeah, there is no state rent regulation for mobile home parks. It's a creature of local regulation by city or county. And as I mentioned, there's literally about, at this point, maybe 106 or 107 such ordinances. I don't have a breakdown at my fingertips for the number of spaces that covers, but most of the ordinances are located in the coastal higher density jurisdictions, where there are more parks. For example, I think San Jose has the most parks within its city limits. It has 65 parks.
Hmm.
The Central Valley area, the more conservative property rights centric area, are where there is no rent stabilization. And those residents basically are subject to paying whatever the park owner says they want. And the problem is mobility. These are captive folks. You know, if the rent goes up, it's not like you're renting an apartment or a condominium and you can just pack up and move down the road. Mobile homes are really immobile homes and immobile home parks. And the courts have recognized the captivity of mobile home residents. There's one famous quote from a Ninth Circuit Court of Opinion that says the park owners have the residents over a barrel.
We're talking about mobile homes, critical component of the affordable housing picture in California, including here in the Bay Area, joined by Bruce Stanton, General Counsel with Golden State Manufactured Homeowners League, Mariah Thompson, Senior Litigator with California Rural Law Center, Randy Keller, who's Manufactured Home Parks Acquisition and Advocacy Manager with the California Center for Cooperative Development. We want to hear from you, too. Maybe you live in one of the Bay Area's many mobile home communities. What are the sort of joys and challenges of living there? The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. The email's forum at kqed.org. Let's bring in Mary Curry, who's a resident of the Marin Valley Mobile Country Club in Nevada. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, just tell us a little bit about your community.
Well, it's a 63-acre property here in Novato, and it's started as a mobile home park back in the 60s. And in 1997, the city of Novato took ownership, took title to the property, which is a little different than most mobile home parks. I think we're the only one owned by a city here in California. But the we have 313 units and about 425 people, and it's a community, capital, bold community.
Yeah, capital C, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really, it's an amazing place to live. I was attracted to moving here. I lived in San Anselmo for a long time, and I needed to downsize and generate some funds to help take care of my mother. And it was just a perfect fit for me. I've been here about 4.5 years. And we have a lot of people that have been here for 30 or more years. I mean,
wow.
It's really an amazing place. It's filled with a lot of different backgrounds. We've got, you know, teachers, nurses, architects, a range of professionals. And one thing that's very interesting here is that 91% of our residents in a survey that was done 2 years ago are low income. And Marin County low income is about $109,000 a year for one person. So we have a lot of people living right on the edge, check to check. And we have
is
a lot
mostly
of
seniors
amenities.
Or?
Yeah, we're over 55. Our community is over 55. And this place is so amazing because of the commitment that people have to bringing interesting programs. One of the recent ones is we have a park market. We connected with a nonprofit called Extra Food, and we provide food 4 days a week through a volunteer program here in the park where people can come get food that is donated by various markets in the area. And that's bringing people about $150 or more dollars a week to their food budget.
Wow.
And those are the kind of services we need here. We've got lectures, exercise classes, swimming pool. I mean, this place is amazing. I mean, I'm always pinching myself. I'm out walking in the morning, and it's just such a great place to live.
We are talking about mobile homes, this critical component of the affordable housing picture in California, joined by Mary Curry, who is a resident of the Marin Valley Mobile Country Club in Novato. We've got Randy Keller, Manufactured Home Parks Acquisitions and Advocacy Manager with the California Center for Cooperative Development. We've got Bruce Stanton, General Counsel with the Golden State Manufactured Homeowners League. And we've got Mariah Thompson, Senior Litigator with California Rural Law Center. Of course, we want to invite you in as well. Would you move into a mobile home? Maybe you're in a mobile home community now. Let us know how life is. 866-733-6786. The email's forum at kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
I'm Mina Kim. On Forum's 9 p.m. rebroadcast, Child Farm Workers. Children as young as 12 can work legally in California's agriculture industry, but they describe unsafe and unsanitary conditions and a fear of speaking up because they can't afford to lose their jobs. Journalist Robert J. Lopez spoke with 61 children who work in California's fields. We'll talk to Lopez about the state's lack of regulatory oversight and how it's responding to his reporting. Join us tonight at 9 on KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all on the web at theschmidt.org, and from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity. Imagine that. The Forum rebroadcast continues at 8:20 here on KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. Alexis Madrigal here. We're talking about mobile homes as affordable housing infrastructure and different models for how they work, what life is like in different types of mobile home communities. Randy Keller, you work for this place called the California Center for Cooperative Development. And part of what you do is help mobile home owners get a hold of the parks where they are, right? What is the standard? Give us first kind of the standard model that you're kind of up against and how things have been changing, and then what your intervention is.
Yes, thank you for having me on. The resident groups that we deal with are trying to purchase their parks, and we use ROC USA, which is Resident-Owned Communities, mm-hmm. a national organization that has 315 type communities nationwide now, and they help us finance the resident group. So they're a great resource for us to work with the owners of the parks and get the residents organized as a cooperative in order to help buy their community as a group, so that they are then getting away from the predatory rental situation that's occurring now with the, you know, larger corporations buying the mom and pops. Most of the mobile home parks in the state were really developed as mom and pop type things, and the corporate buyers have been coming in. So, you know, that's where we're trying to help residents. And so residents do contact us and say, hey, we're finding out that our park is for sale. Can you help? And so we'll go in and take a look and do some numbers on, you know, can you afford to buy the park? And if so, we'll help them make the offer and go forward with the transaction and get some financing together and possibly some grant funding from the HCD, the Housing Community Development of California, or HUD, this federal organization. And we'll try and put some grant monies together to help with the acquisition of the park for the residents.
Mm. How often are you able to actually make it work?
Unfortunately, very seldomly so far. We do maybe one a year, and mostly that's a funding issue. The price that most owners want for the communities is based on land values in California and what it could be generating income-wise. And so the rents in most of these communities, especially the rent-stabilized ones, are not efficient, you know, not
maximizing the rent.
Yeah, and so they're, you know, and so we're trying to bridge a gap. We're trying to bridge a gap in the financing we're going to get. So we're going to borrow some money at 6% from ROC, for instance, and fund the community that way. In other words, a loan being paid back over 30 years. And so we're competing against investment capital, which is, money that somebody drops into a park, a big corporation drops in there, and they're only looking for a 4-6% return. So that's where we have a gap, and that's where we look for grant funding from the state or foundation funding. And so that's been our challenge. You know, how do we bridge that gap and get this affordable for the residents so they don't have a very large acquisition rent increase? Because that's what occurs. And that's what we're faced with Marin. For instance, we're working on that particular deal right now.
Yeah.
The one that Mary is in.
Yeah. Let's bring in a caller here. We're going to return to that issue. Nick in Hayward, welcome.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to touch base. I'm a contractor working in the manufactured housing space and have been for the last 15 years. And there's a saying within the industry that there's nothing less affordable than affordable housing. There's a lot of costs that are hidden or just within the manufacturing process, the maintenance and upkeep on the houses. Your previous guest was touching on space rent issues. We've seen space rent skyrocket around the Bay Area, with some parks over $3,000 a month to rent the land. Plus you still have to do the mortgage on your park. So one of the things that, I've seen over the years is the builders, the manufacturers have gotten better at making longer lasting, less upkeep in housing, but the main issue that we still see is, you know, how the interaction between the park and the homeowner and the affordability issue is kind of right there at that nexus. And many parks don't make improvements into the parks. Electrical systems are old and failing, gas systems are old and failing, and they just aren't getting maintained, and the homeowners suffer.
Mm. Man, Nick, thanks so much for that perspective. I mean, Mary, talk to me a little bit about that, at least the way you've encountered it. Obviously, a little bit different ownership model where you are with the city of Novato owning the location.
Yeah. Working with the city of Novato, we go through an annual budget process, and we actually pay all of our operating expenses, and we pay a loan that the city of Novato took out in 1997 to buy the property. We pay $651,000 a year and actually match that, and have to have it set aside for capital improvements. And the hard part for us is the city is not very responsive to the capital improvements that we need. One example would be a roof that we've been needing on our clubhouse, and we've been waiting 3 years to get it. And the city has to go through California contracting law. And one of the main reasons we want to be self-owned is to not have to go through that process and to actually have higher prices that we're paying for capital improvements. We always operate in a way that we pay all of our operating, as I just said. And so Our big fear here as residents is being owned by the city is a slippery slope, because they could sell us. And they did it, entertain an offer in 2023, which is what got us organized and connected with Randy's organization. We really want to own this place so we can have control over our affordable future and our security for the future. Yeah. Right now we're just sitting in a slippery slope.
Mariah, are the people that you work with, I mean, you're with the California Rural Law Center, so I assume that the mobile homes that you're kind of thinking about have a slightly different set of issues than the ones, say, in Novato or down in Sunnyvale. But do they have, like, sort of common goals but sort of different ways of getting there?
Yeah, so I'm always really excited to talk about this issue, because I actually do represent residents that did buy their park. Group of families in Fresno County who are Oaxacan farm workers who were able to acquire their park a number of years ago after about 5 years of litigation with one of these corporate equity firms that had come in and significantly increased the park rent, had failed to maintain the on-site sewer system. So the park smelled like the inside of a sewer. And at the end of bringing 5 years of litigation, working with Randy's group, we were able to acquire funding in a pretty rare situation, honestly, because we got a capital stack on it that included grants from the state, including a farm worker housing grant, and their rent actually went down, which is pretty rare for mobile home park acquisition. So we saw rents that got down to around, I believe, or maybe even below the 500 range. And those residents now own their park and are managing it very well and have been getting additional grants for beautification of the park and have rent stabilized moving forward. A lot of the places that I represent, I represent a number of places in the Bay as well, resident associations. And the first thing they say when I walk in the door is, hey, you help people buy their park. We want to buy our park too.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, why don't you tell us a little bit about what they're up against? Like, who are the kind of private equity players, these investors who are buying things up. One of the, my understanding of it at least is that like Berkshire Hathaway, you know, like Warren Buffett's investment company is like heavily invested in like mobile home parks. Is that the kind of folks you're up against?
To some degree, there are what I would call the large box, big box park owners that have come into California or that are already here because they see the lucrative, you know, sort of cutting coupons type of investment that they don't have to put a lot of time or money into. But there are also emerging park owners, park owner conglomerates or, you know, entities that are forming separate LLCs for each park that they acquire that are not really what you would call private equity per se, but more, in the know about how to do this. And there's a couple of these corporations in particular that have been acquiring the smaller to mid-sized parks and then seeking to increase cash flow, like, as I mentioned before, filing administrative rent petitions or giving notices to residents that if they don't respond or correct something, you know, they might be they could possibly be terminated. One of the things to kind of piggyback on the prior discussion as well is residents do have a remedy for infrastructure failure issues called failure to maintain actions. There's a law firm in San Diego that actually specializes in this and has a history of bringing lawsuits against park owners who they term to be slumlords, frankly, and they get multi-million dollar jury verdicts in some cases or large settlements. So, I mean, it can be a very tough case to put together. There's a lot of proof required, but you're looking at all kinds of issues of how infrastructure is failing in so many ways. Park owners do have the ability as well to upgrade gas and electric systems pursuant to a what was once a pilot and is now a permanent program with the California Public Utilities Commission to do what's called a line extension upgrade, where all the ratepayers in California are now paying a few cents on the bill for mobile home park gas and electric infrastructure to be upgraded by the serving utility. So they have an ability to get in the queue, and the cost of the park owner is fairly minimal compared to the overall cost of upgrading the system.
We've got a caller, Chris in Gualala. Welcome.
Hey, hi. I'm interested in finding out how a group of mobile home owners at a 50-unit park on the coast here in Gualala can initiate buying their actual rental spaces, even though the park owner may not be happy about it.
You're having some issues with the owner?
Oh, well, no, the owners are fine. It's just that we would like to own our spaces and not be sort of like what is termed under the over the barrel.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Thanks for that, Chris. Maybe Randy, we should start with you.
Yeah, and that's something our organization does quite often. We field a lot of questions from residents just like yourself who would like to acquire their park. So that's why we're here, and we will work with your group. You can contact us at cccd.coop and give us a call, shoot us an email, and we'll try and work with you and see if we can make a deal with your park owner, you know, because, you know, everything's for sale at a price. We just have to see if we can come to terms.
Yeah, yeah. All right, hey, thank you. Thank you for that. You know, I am curious, you know, Mariah, when we are looking at the Bay Area specifically, what do you see as like distinct about the issues here versus like in general in the state or in the Central Valley?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I sort of cut my teeth in mobile home advocacy in the Bay Area. I was based out of Fresno for the last 10 years, and I'm more statewide now. And like Bruce said earlier, in the Central Valley, especially in the rural county areas, there's no rent control at all. There's no local protections for additional rent control or special protections around mobile home closures, which are happening. You know, threats of closure is very common when some of these companies that are seeking very high rent increases, sometimes 300% rent increases, are not able to accomplish that. They'll turn around and say, oh, well, we're just going to shut down your park, and sort of try and strong arm people into that. And one of the things that we're seeing in the Bay Area that's really great to see is local jurisdictions that are standing up for the homeowners, the seniors, the lower income individuals that are living in these parks. You know, we see cities like, you know, San Jose, Petaluma. You know, I represent tenants in Windsor that where the city just passed a temporary moratorium on park closures while they update their park closure protections after a park where we represent tenants threatened to close when, you know, because they were not able to immediately get a rent increase that they were looking for. And I'm actually going into arbitration on that case tomorrow. And so that's simply something that I'm hoping that we'll see jurisdictions emulate throughout the state of California, is taking the initiative, especially to proactively take the initiative to you know, improve protections for tenants in their communities that are residing in the parks, whether that be through local ordinances or making sure that their zoning is updated so that these are just zoned as mobile home parks and can't be converted into condominiums, or, you know, there's plenty of other ways that the local jurisdictions can protect residents as well.
Yeah, you know, Bruce, I was wondering about that. How many of these acquisitions are for operating these mobile home parks, and how many are, you're essentially buying it, you're going to squeeze people out of there, and then you're going to try and, yeah, put in some new type of housing there, or a new type of development?
Yeah, certainly when you look at the history of mobile home parks, you know, many of these parks, as Mariah mentioned at the top, have been parks that have been here for decades. And the parks were built in the outskirts areas, the more hinterlands of metropolitan areas. Well, growth has happened, and growth is now caught up to where the parks are located. And so there can be the temptation that, well, we've got a higher and better use of our land now. You know, we can not only have our housing, you know, horizontal, but we can have it vertical, and we can go, you know, 4-6 stories up. Or we could change the use altogether. So not only is it important to have the zoning that keeps it as a mobile home park and protects the equity, this is a sunk equity cost that these residents have. They purchase the homes, they landscape them, they attach decks and awnings and porches and build sheds. And there's a lot of sunk costs that can't be movable. So protecting equity is really critical.
Yeah. And there is some concern, right, with SB 79, which allows for more housing density near transportation, that that's actually going to possibly open up some of these mobile home communities and make them vulnerable to different types of development. Is that a real concern?
Yeah, I think that it's a potential, because it could offer incentive. And there are some efforts underway, as I understand it right now, to be sure that mobile home parks are exempted from that legislation for that very purpose, because we certainly don't want to encourage that by sort of unintended legislation that has as its object something that's, you know, completely different from the reality that mobile home park owners would face if a closure were threatened. One important thing to mention is state law and the government code has been strengthened in recent years to align with some of the local cities and counties that have closure or conversion ordinances, to say that if you have to try to relocate everybody in your park, and if you can't do that, you have to buy them out at fair market value, which is determined as if the park was not closing.
Hmm. We're talking about mobile homes, critical component of our affordable housing picture, often overlooked, though. We've got Bruce Stanton, General Counsel with Golden State Manufactured Homeowners League. We've got Mariah Thompson, Senior Litigator with the California Rural Law Center. Got Randy Keller, Manufactured Home Parks Acquisition and Advocacy Manager with the California Center for Cooperative Development. And we've got Mary Curry, a resident with Marin Valley Mobile Country Club in Novato. We'll be back with more right after the break. Coming up in the next hour of Forum with Mina Kim, child farm workers. Children as young as 12 can work legally in California's agricultural industry, but they describe unsafe and unsanitary conditions, extreme heat, and a fear of speaking up because they can't afford to lose their jobs. Journalist Robert J. Lopez spoke with 61 children who work in the fields in Salinas, Santa Maria, San Joaquin, and the Pajaro Valleys. We're going to talk to Lopez about the state's lack of regulatory oversight and how it's responding to his reporting. To listen to any Fast Forum show, go to Apple Podcasts and find us there. We're KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. Alexis Madrigal here. We're talking about mobile homes as affordable housing stock. The number is 866-733-6786. If you want to share your experience in the mobile home community or around them, 866-733-6786, forum at kqed.org. We've got the California Rural Law Center's Mariah Thompson. We've got the Golden State Manufactured Homeowners League's General Counsel, that's Bruce Stanton. We've got Randy Keller with California Center for Cooperative Development. And we've got Mary Curry, a resident at Marin Valley Mobile Country Club, which is owned by the City of Novato and is in Novato. Steve over on the Discord has an interesting question. I think I'm going to send this to you, Randy. He says, I feel like it's a bit more financially complex and risky to go co-op with mobile homes. I'm not saying it can't or shouldn't be done, but I think there should be some extra scrutiny and maybe some changes to the, quote, standard co-op arrangement. Setting up explicitly as a public benefit corporation seems apt, though I expect there's a lot more to it.
Yes, and that's a model we like to use because it's a little more streamlined, because the other way to do this is condo it out. In other words, do a subdivision map to get everybody to own their lot privately. That takes quite a bit of time. And when we're talking about a sale or transfer from an owner to residence, most owners don't want to wait through that process. So at least with the co-op model, and we're using the limited equity housing co-op, which is a state code, it's 817. That helps us, you know, do this in a fashion where we can go through the sales process in about 90 to 120 days. So we can't do that in a subdivision type situation with that type of speed.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. Matthew writes, and maybe Mary, I'll bring this one to you. You know, my sister lives in Reading in a bad part of town on a main drag lined with self-storage units. Unhoused folks wander down her street in a drugged-up haze. Her landlord refuses to add even basic lighting for safety, no common spaces or amenities. I've learned that trailer parks are exempt from many of the standards applied to other forms of housing. I mean, that may be, I think Matthew's experience is one, you know, where I grew up, there were lots of mobile home parks, and there was such a great variety between, you know, and differences between them. What's it been like to kind of advocate for a place where people may have, you know, Matthew's experience in mind, and they're you know, that's kind of their baseline for what these places are?
It's very different here, in Novato. We're not challenged by those same kinds mm-hmm. of things. And so we're pretty blessed in that regard. I think that, you know, the thing that we're most facing right now here at Marin Valley Mobile Country Club is that the city owns the title to our property mm-hmm. and we want to buy it. And the price has not been able to be agreed upon. They're holding out at $26 million, and that's not affordable. We can afford 20. So I'm changing the subject here on you, but that's our biggest concern. We've been living in fear since 2023 because we don't know the future of our property. And the city says they'll protect us if they keep us, but they can't do that. They'd have to have legislation dedicating us to never be sold. Mm-hmm. They can't do that.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I was more. Oh, go ahead, Maya. Yeah.
I'd be happy to jump in here real quick on this topic.
Yes, please.
Not to interrupt, but the caller is correct that what we would call code enforcement in mobile home parks is a different beast than it would be within, for example, city limits. The code enforcement aspect and health and safety aspects of mobile home parks, as well as this includes the requirements of what mobile home park owners are mandated by law to provide for their residents, is governed by the health and safety code at the state level. And so this is a really misunderstood area of mobile home park law, that if you have a problem in your mobile home park, such as there's no street lighting, you know, which is obligated to be provided by the landlord, you don't call your local code enforcement department. You actually would need to call the state of California, which is a department called the Department of Housing and Community Development, which was touched on earlier. And they have a, you know, codes and standards division that will come out to mobile home parks and do inspections and write up a park owner for the various violations. Now, it can be a double-edged sword, because if a park-wide inspection occurs and it's a park that is primarily folks that are lower income and have, you know, not been able to keep up with all the maintenance on their trailers over time, you know, especially these units that are from the 60s, the 70s, you know, there are risks that residents can also get dinged, but you know, the park owner is required by law to provide a healthy and safe environment, especially the common areas. We're talking, yeah, you know, roads that are in good condition, lighting, sidewalks, you know, infrastructure systems that are being maintained. And so if residents are experiencing that kind of the issue, they can call the Department of Housing and Community Development and ask them to come out and look at the conditions in the park and see if there's something that they can do.
I guess I was also thinking about kind of the broader politics here. Like, if people don't think mobile home parks are good housing, then perhaps there'll be less support for keeping them around, especially if it requires passing new laws and making different kinds of investments or loaning money in different ways. Like, for example, one listener writes in to say, I'm not sure this is great affordable housing. They sound expensive, and maybe this space would be better used to build denser housing for families. Like, how would you respond to that, Mariah?
Well, I think that there's a real misunderstanding around mobile home parks. I think that many people live with a, you know, mental picture of a mobile home park as a kind of trashed space with a series of tin cans, and people that don't care about their housing. And I think that that's a stigma that has, you know, is honestly a classist stigma that has been perpetuated by media and movies and this, you know, the concept of, you know, of white trash and all this stuff, which I would say is, someone who works extensively in this field, then I think everyone in this panel would agree is a nonsense, to be honest, if you have experience with these communities. It's not, you know, it's not a waste of resources in protecting people's homes. And I do think that it says something about the way that we view people and certain areas of the economic spectrum to think that their housing is just not worth preserving. Their home ownership is not worth preserving. But we wouldn't talk about, you know, bulldozing a single family subdivision because we could build a high rise condo there. I just think that it goes to show how much additional education needs to be done about, you know, preserving this kind of housing and this home ownership opportunity. Yeah.
What would you say, Bruce? Like, why aren't we building any more of these? Is it just that they're sort of, they're not that much denser than single family, developments, although they are. But there's this kind of sense that apartment buildings or other kinds of affordable housing that goes up just allows us to build denser, and therefore, I guess, I don't know, we could get more housing units for the same land.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's going to be a lot of emphasis upon that, obviously, because of, you know, increasing population and especially in urban areas. But, you know, as Mariah said, this is a misunderstood, I think, form of housing or industry. I think the failure or the lack of new parks over the last 10 to 20 years being built is probably a function of land availability more than anything else. I'm sure park owners would say it's also a function of overregulation. You know, why does somebody want to come into an industry that's so heavily regulated? But on the other hand, you have these corporations, as we've already discussed, that are coming in and they want to buy these parks. And I even get these anonymous or unsolicited, I guess I should say, entreaties from third parties saying, hey, if you know about an opportunity for a park to be purchased, let us know. We have a client that wants to do a 1031 exchange, something like that. This kind of housing is different from the high density sort of buildings because it offers home ownership of the structure. It offers the ability for somebody to live in a landscaped space, even though it may not be a large space. If you go online and look at some of the homes that are for sale in places like Sunnyvale, you're going to find triple wide homes with site built garages, textured walls, vaulted ceilings. There are even such a thing as two story homes that exist mostly in Southern California in the coastal parks. So these are not the aluminum tin cans that people picture, you know, when they picture trailer parks. People who live in mobile home parks do not want to be called, you know, trailer owners. They don't want to be known as people living in trailer parks.
Yeah. Bring in Ashley. Real quick, and we'll come back.
Yeah, if I could just add, the pride that people have in their homes here in this community is amazing. I mean, we've got gardens. People keep up their places. So it's by no means the old image of trailer trash.
Ashley in San Leandro, welcome.
Hi, Alexis. Thank you guys for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. I am a resident in Bayshore Commons in San Leandro. And I purchased my home in 2021. I am a tech professional, but I come from, I basically started my way up here in the Bay Area 7 years ago. And I, you know, with housing prices, I wasn't able to buy a home in the traditional sense. It's just me. I'm a single person out here living. And so I thought, okay, let me entertain the idea of a tiny home. And there was a spot open in Bayshore Commons, and I thought, okay, I've got some stock. Let me sell it. Let me move in. And it seemed like a great idea at the time. And then as I've been living here, I've been talking to my neighbors and the other residents, and it seems like we're just embattled with the people who have bought our property. So the city of San Leandro put in a rent control ordinance because of the company, Harmony Communities, who bought our park. And so we're kind of in the wiggle room of being a mobile home park because we have a lot of tiny homes. But, I mean, they're still considered mobile homes. We take a lot of pride in them. And I just wanted to comment that we have high rent. It's been when they bought it in 2018, they doubled it for some residents. They're doing those same tactics like the fair return, increase application, and we have high rent but low amenities. Like our laundry room, that's pretty much the only thing we have besides parking. And so it seems pretty unreasonable to have such high rent prices with not a lot of things that they provide.
Like what are we talking rent-wise?
So I am paying almost $1,100 a month, and that's just rent. Some of the other residents pay more, some pay less. But before I moved here, there was a resident who only paid like $500 or $600. Yeah. And then when Harmony Communities bought it, they doubled it or increased it 25-50% for some residents.
And San Leandro, the city of, has been somewhat helpful, in the sense that they passed this ordinance that sort of stabilized your rent?
Yes, and they were really helpful to gather, to let us know about the fair increase application, because without the letters that they had sent to us and that I had seen, they were just probably going to get a yes
gonna show
for
up.
Their fair return. Because we're, as residents, we're allowed to protest and make comment on that, and so we're still in ongoing litigation for that particular thing.
Cool. Actually, stay on the line for one sec. We have a reporter who might want to talk to you. There's a similar comment in some ways, and thank you so much for sharing your experience. CJ writes in to say, is mobile home park rent in the Bay Area approaching apartment prices now? Many parks I'm seeing are charging $1,200 to $1,600 per month just for the pad, not including utilities. For those currently renting space, what are you paying? What's included? I'm trying to understand whether mobile home living is still meaningfully cheaper than apartments. Bruce, I might bring this one to you.
I'm by no means an expert in apartments, and I don't track those rents, but it's clear that in some areas, especially again the coastal areas, the more, you know, metropolitan areas, and I think about the city of Sunnyvale, because Sunnyvale has never had rent stabilization, and only within the past couple of years something called a memorandum of understanding was negotiated, which took almost a year to put into place between the city and the park owners, with resident, you know, involvement in the discussions to try to stabilize rents. And so when you look at a community like that and you see space ground rents of $2,500 plus, you could certainly compare that to apartment rents. I think from what I understand, sort of looking at that area, apartment rents are still higher. But when you, the problem is for a mobile homeowner, you have not only your space rent, but in many cases, you've also got a loan payment and you are responsible to maintain the home. You know, that's a maintenance load that you have to calculate into your budget.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to make sure I get to these listener comments. We really appreciate how much engagement there's been on this topic here. One listener on Discord writes, I've been browsing homes for sale in different Bay Area counties. Mobile homes continue to pop up in my very modest price range. I saw some decent interiors with nice upgrades and yards, so then I researched forums online. One post coined the truth. You're buying an expensive car with plumbing and renting an overpriced parking spot. That closed the book on that option for me. Mulzaho over on the Discord writes, my lineage is working class, fixed income, southern cotton pickers from the Depression era. I've had several family members own mobile homes in Northern California and Texas, but they purchased land to put it on. What a cool reality to hear that people can be evicted from a lot while still being a homeowner. Jordan writes, one guest mentioned that some of the parks are being shut down because they are not the highest and best use of the land, as increasing density would make space for 4 to 6 story apartments. Could this higher value use of the land be an opportunity to give current park residents ownership, give them all condos in the future building, find some other way to allow participation in value creation? And Eddie has another forward-looking question. So many mobile home parks in California are located in the floodplain of rivers and creeks. How does this impact the purchase of these parks, either by the residents or by private companies? I don't want anyone to have to take on all of those questions all at once, but maybe, Randy Keller, you can just speak briefly to the idea of the future of these mobile home parks and how, you know, cooperatives might be part of it.
Yeah, in general, I think the cooperative model is the best model. I mean, right now, all of these owners of these homes who have quite a bit of equity in their homes are subject to rent, to become renters and owners at the same time. So what we're trying to do is create ownership for them. And that's, I think, the end game for this. You know, if everybody could own their own communities, then all of the rental problems, in a sense, go away.
Yeah.
You know, they become owners, and I'll let somebody else in the forum go.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to hop in with one last listener comment, and we're going to have to go. Sreed writes, I'm wondering why co-op housing is not thriving in California. Those who are in the medium income group are struggling, especially young people, and cooperative housing seems like something they could afford. Are there any state regulations preventing or discouraging groups from coming together, buying a development, and building housing? Randy, I assume that is not actually for you. So Mariah, super quick, like 5 seconds, where would you direct people who might be interested in that?
Yeah, well, I think a really exciting thing that's happening in the cooperative housing world is this concept of community land trusts, mm-hmm. where there are community land trusts that are purchasing property and working with residents to, you know, construct mm-hmm. or own the land or lease the land for sometimes a 100-year lease that allows them to own the, you know, the buildings on top mm-hmm. of it. We've seen it historically in the apartment context, but more and more there's been talk about trying to use that model of community mm-hmm. land trusts plus resident cooperatives to encourage homeownership at a mm-hmm. price that doesn't impact the land acquisition as much.
So great. We've been joined by Mariah Thompson, Bruce Stanton, Randy Keller, and Mary Curry. We've been talking about mobile homes as affordable housing. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thank you to all of our listeners. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the Generosity Foundation and the members of KQED.
The next hour of KQED's Forum is about California's child farm workers. It starts after your traffic update, including the continuing trouble in Benicia. With the latest, here's Al Rogers.
We have a major accident eastbound 780 after Military West. CHP investigating that accident. Have all lanes closed. They're estimating until 9:30 this evening. And we have roadwork for the westbound Bay Bridge between Treasure Island and the San Francisco Anchorage. The two right lanes closed till 4 a.m. Al Rogers for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Frontline PBS, presenting 2,000 Meters to Andriivka, a documentary about Ukrainian soldiers fighting for every inch of their land in the Russian-Ukraine war, now streaming on PBS.org and the PBS app, awards eligible. I'm Michelle Hennigan, and you're listening to member-supported